Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that Sam. It's gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte. In the studio today, we're going to be talking shop with Leif Hockman and Jeremy Ortel from Donna in South Williamsburg on Broadway between Wythe and Kent, a fairly new place that just opened recently, and it's a very lovely, romantic spot with great cocktails and good vibes. And welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us, man.
Yeah, thanks for having
Absolutely. So give me like the Cliff's Notes, like rundown of what the like the mission statement and idea behind Donna was when you came to decide to open a bar.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, we're 5.5 months in now, and what happened was about 3 years ago, I was managing for Santos Party House, and I'd been bumming around managing for restaurants and bars and clubs, and got to a point where I was fed up because I couldn't change the things that I wanted to change because it wasn't within my authority to do so. And so I decided to get out of Manhattan for a second and went to go bartend at Marlowe & Sons, which was right around the corner from where I lived, which was an amazing place to work because of the quality of produce and product that they had in there and the seriousness with which the staff took the entire project. That, you know, working at a restaurant can be something that people don't care about very much. And it's nice to be in a place that takes itself seriously, but in a very friendly and casual way. And so at that place, I started to really come to the idea that I was either going to change my life entirely and go back to school or do something else, but I didn't dislike my life. I enjoyed the restaurant industry. I enjoyed the socialness of it and being convivial, you know. And I decided, I was like, well, I think I could, if I was going to do anything that I had a really clear vision about, it would be to open up a bar. And that's where Donna began. And it was bits and pieces of the my favorite places I'd worked for or had frequented. And for me, that was about creating a space that was, what I had said before was like an elegant space for dirty kids, you know, a place that, because I'm 31 now, I don't really want to go to a dive bar every night of the week. I do sometimes, you know, but sometimes sure. I want to have dinner at Marlowe & Sons and then walk down the street and have a great cocktail in a space that's just as beautiful or just as transportive. And I wanted to create a space that was like that, but where you could also avoid some of the stuffiness of other cocktail bars, and where you could maybe get a beer and a shot and hang out. And maybe there's a band playing, or maybe there's a DJ playing some like rock and roll music, you know. Find a way to meld these two worlds that was really based on, I think, a space that the neighborhood didn't have before. And one that I thought I could execute at a high level, something I could be really proud of, and that's how we got to where we got to now.
That's great. I mean, like, some of the elements that I like about it, I mean, like, it's like just as far as like the welcoming atmosphere of the space itself. You have the bar is beautiful, but then you have these really great, like, cool, like, kind of vaulted ceilings,
yeah.
And you actually have windows that open out to the street,
right.
You know. So, it, like, with so many cocktail dens and like speakeasy style bars, you have, you know, you got to walk through a secret door and a weird secret handshake, right. Or you know, you have to yeah. jump through hoops just to get in and
right.
sit down at the bar.
Which I think for some of those spaces those become attractive qualities to an extent. You know, when you really want to have
sure.
that experience, but Sometimes you also, I think, want to just be able to go to a place on the regular, you know, and not have to really feel like you have to go into a different mindset or dress up for it or something like that, you know?
Sure.
And that's, I think that's important about a neighborhood bar. It needs to be welcoming. It needs to be inviting and open. And with Donna specifically, also, I think in contrast to some of the other bars, there's a real feminine quality to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I felt was important because a lot of the bars that you go into kind of feel like, you know, masculine, dungeony spaces.
Yeah, it's a bunch of dudes.
It's a bunch of dudes nerding out on some, you know, stuff, which is totally cool, you know. But I walk into Donna sometimes and I'm like, it's like 90% women in here. You know?
That's great. I'm going to go there after this.
Yeah, exactly. It's true though, right? I mean, yeah, it has a really...
Sometimes I look in there and I just can't believe it's almost always girls.
Yeah, that's like I said after the show. Like I was saying before with the architecture, like it has even like, you know, it's curvy and elegant and yeah, definitely feminine.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not only inviting for people to come in and like sit down and have a drink, but you want to like hang out there for a while.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of times with cocktail bars, you go in and you're like, oh, I'm going to like spend, you know, $13 to $20 on this cocktail. And then I'm like on my way somewhere else. And with that place, it does have that neighborhood kind of quality to it.
Yeah. And I think you bring up another point, which is that the other, I think, excluding factor with a lot of those cocktail bars for, you know, for people, I mean, even if we're working in the industry and we're getting purchased around here and there or all the time, you know, like it's expensive to go to some of those places. And if you want to be able to have a good drink and it costs you $13 to $16 to get it, you're probably only gonna have like one, you know, at least, yeah. I mean, in my income bracket, you know?
Yeah.
But I think, keeping our cocktail prices low was something that I talked about with Jeremy from the very beginning when we first met, because I think that's also another aspect of having an inviting space that kids, that my friends could hang out in and not feel like they could only do it on a special occasion.
Sure.
Or maybe, you know, maybe they're going to have that cocktail first and then they'll follow it up with a $4 beer, and that's sure. Totally okay too.
And that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. You know, yeah. We talk about this a lot on this show, you know, we'll ask, you know, all the guests that come on, like what their favorite drink is. At the end of the day, a lot of them are like, you know, these are like big names in like cocktail culture, right. And bartending, and they're like a Bud and a shot of Fernet,
exactly,
you know. And
yeah.
It's like it's pretty much consistent across the board. It's like it's either like a cheap beer and a whiskey, or a cheap beer and some sort of Amaro. Mm-hmm. And you know, we work so much on workshopping these cocktails, and you know. Recently, we talked about, you know, it takes 50 tries to come up with the right cocktail.
Sure. And
I was talking with a buddy last night, and we were talking about how, like, even, like, Don the Beachcomber and, like, Trader Vic and those guys, like, oh, this has exactly 3 drops of absinthe in it. Not 2, not 7, it has 3. Mm-hmm. And if you do it any other way, it's going to be completely fucked up. And it's not going to taste right. So there's so much workshopping and stuff that goes into it. By the end of the day, like we're just like burned out on it, and we're like, oh, let's have a round of beers, man.
Yeah,
so,
or even like even working a whole shift, you know, tasting drink after drink after drink.
Sure.
I mean, by the end of it, you just want whiskey and a Tecate or something, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I think it's funny too, because a lot of the skill, there, you know, there are people who make those kind of beverages that are really special. Have a real skill. They have to be super tasters. They really have to know those kind of minute variations that make that the difference between a well-balanced and complex cocktail and a cocktail that just has a bunch of bullshit in it, you know. And I think that most people, when they walk into a space, they're not super tasters. They don't know. And if you sell it with confidence, they'll still enjoy it. That doesn't mean that one should trump the other, you know.
Sure.
But at the same time, like you have to educate the clientele who comes in here to be able to notice those nuances, you know. Now, that doesn't mean they might not already enjoy it, but to really pick out all those tiny little details that are going on.
Give me an example of that.
I would say, I guess probably Well, like I guess like with a even like a simple cocktail like a Manhattan, like a classic cocktail, sure, like that. Making small variations in the vermouths that you're going to choose, mm-hmm, that go into it. The balance of vermouth, if you're going to go all the way sweet or if you're going to do a perfect.
Or you can split your sweet vermouths. I always split, mm-hmm, my sweets, like in a Negroni and a Manhattan. I always do Carpano and Dolan.
Yeah, of course. You know, and which that's actually my preference as well. I mean, I prefer a perfect Manhattan to a sweet Manhattan. Most people will come in ordering Manhattan and order it with bourbon, right? And they're looking for bourbon and sweet vermouth and garnish with a cherry or something like that. Still, I mean, to this day, even, sure, though there's like, you know, dozens of cocktail bars that are you know, educating against that. But people, I think once you're able to show them these subtle differences in using vermouths that are also preserved appropriately, they're not sitting in a well for, right, a year, you know, getting disgusting. Their palate starts to become more sensitive, and then that creates a better customer, especially for our type of bar, over time, because they're more discerning, and they're going to appreciate the things that come into it.
Yeah. So, give me a rundown of like what you guys have on the menu, as far as like. I know that before the show, Jeremy and I were talking about, like, you know, the Phil Ward approach to classics and then swapping out ingredients to make new cocktails. You know, for instance, you know, I can't remember who this, it might have been Delta Groff or something, but talking about just like pretty much any classic cocktail, you can add a little bit of like fruit eau de vie, mm-hmm, you know, any kind of like distilled like brandy to a classic, and then it takes on this whole new level and it goes into a different direction. Like, how are you guys doing that there?
So I've been working with Phil for a little while, and I've been kind of inspired by, you know, seeing what he did with Mayuel, because some of those drinks are my favorite drinks to drink, period. So I kind of started a lot of my ideas from, you know, that direction, you know, thinking, oh, well, this is a great drink. Maybe I can, you know, use these ingredients to sort of get this sort of flavor, you know, but sort of using them as templates to
sure,
to start with. And then also we were doing Central American, like sort of Latin food. So fitting that theme, I thought we could use a lot of rum, which is also really helpful when you're trying to keep your costs down, because as we know, rum is,
yeah,
relatively cheap. So, you know, we were thinking about doing a lot of rum-based cocktails, but then also kind of, not everybody wants rum, you know, so we're doing some tequila and mezcal, trying to keep a small list, but, you know, having something for everybody.
Absolutely. Well, that's the whole goal, really, is like, mm-hmm, having something for everyone. You can't have everything for everyone, but you need to have, yeah, something for everyone.
Well, and this idea of also doing simple variations of classics, so that, because, you know, if you, the classic cocktails have existed for so long because they're well balanced, and they're, you know, they hit a certain part of our palate that is just, it's generally pleasing. And to do a house cocktail list, I think you should be able to, it's really your identity comes from that list. So you want to be able to have a strong identity, but one that isn't, again, just like kind of like a grab bag of ingredients, sure, thrown together. And, you know, I've been really impressed with the work that Jeremy did in terms of that. And one variations that were surprising, too, like the Broncolata, where he's using Broncamenta, which is an incredibly difficult, it's a difficult spirit to mess around with. I mean, you'll see it as rinses or...
I'll disagree with you, because I use the shit out of really? Renette Branca and Broncamenta.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I have...
Zamaros.
Yeah, I mean, I have been generally disappointed by cocktails that utilize... Oh, damn, he's showing us a tattoo. But, I mean, this is a spirit that we all really enjoy to drink solo most of the time. Or maybe, like, you know, you see people do, like, Fernet and Coke.
Fernet and Coke,
yeah. Which is awesome.
Which is actually like that kind of fits the bill with like you were talking about the Central American and South American fair, you know, yep. Fernet con Coca being like, yep, the official drink of Argentina.
Totally.
You know.
Yeah, so I mean, we have simple things like the rum and coke on the menu, but we use Mexican coke, a, mm-hmm, little squeeze of lime, a couple dashes of Angostura, mm-hmm, put it in a big fancy hurricane glass, you know, so it's not, yeah, just, mm-hmm, your average rum,
see,
and coke.
I love that. I love that, man. You know, There are certain drinks like you said, like a rum and coke, mm-hmm, or like a gin and tonic that have been so bastardized over the years,
right,
that are simple and and refreshing, and they hit the mark, you know? Mm-hmm. And I always say that a gin and tonic shouldn't be just gin and tonic.
Yeah.
You know, I always try to make them like, you know, Spanish style, like where it's, you've got some different fruits in there, maybe some maraschino, some absinthe, you know, you got to church it up,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I love that you're doing that with this menu, you know? That's also, it goes back to like the simplicity and also the very welcoming nature of what you guys are doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's such a backlash nowadays against like the everything in the kitchen sink, you know, style cocktails, and to nail it, you know, with just the minimal amount of ingredients,
right,
and to make it refreshing and welcoming and delicious. I mean, it's like one of the greatest riffs on a classic cocktail, which, you know, Don the Beachcomber did the QB Cooler. And then that was 9 ingredients. And then Trader Vic did the Mai Tai, which is a riff mm-hmm. on it. And if you put them side by side, it's pretty hard to tell which one is which.
Mm. Yeah.
You know? But taking that from 9 ingredients to 5 ingredients
yeah.
and nailing it, and mm-hmm. which one do you hear about more? The Mai Tai, yeah, or the course. QB Cooler,
yeah, totally.
You know? So yeah. that's a perfect example of like just killing it, you know, mm-hmm. with like ingenuity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another fun drink that we did, the daiquiri, the Donna daiquiri. I just, you know, having bartenders come into like Dram where I was working before and always ordering daiquiris with their own little, you know, they want this rum and this rum and, you know, an ounce of lime juice for sweet quarter simple or cane mm-hmm. or whatever, you know, and then thinking, wow, I just want to make one that's like, you know, a blend of rums I pick and just try to get everybody to drink daiquiri, you know, have this mission to like get everybody to drink a daiquiri because people are some, you know, they think it's a joke when they ask me, what's your favorite drink to drink? And I say, well, daiquiri, you know, and they're like, oh yeah, you're kidding me, right?
Well, that's because, again, it's been bastardized, man.
It has,
you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like,
it,
you know,
people think of like crushed ice and, you know, it looks like a snow cone or something.
Yeah, but like, I think across the board, most bartenders that I've talk to will say that is their favorite drink, even over a Manhattan. Obviously, mm-hmm. a Manhattan is kind of a perfect drink.
Yeah.
It's 3 ingredients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a really easy to remember formula, and it's always delicious.
I think that the daiquiri and the gimlet, too, it's like, you know, that's kind of, yeah. that becomes the benchmark for a good bartender. You give them a simple cocktail like that because it's so easy to mess up because it's so simple.
That's a good point. You know, like even going back to Phil Ward, he said, you know, there are so many bartenders out there nowadays. It's a great thing that we're enthusiastic about our craft and that it's come to the spotlight and we're back on track, you know, because mm-hmm. we went through some dark decades mm-hmm. there totally. For a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, it's like new bartenders need to learn the fundamentals and like not only in technique, but in recipes, you mm-hmm. know how to make a French 75.
Yeah.
You know, the right way.
And because I think what's fascinating about once you break the code of cocktail making is that it becomes almost like a Rubik's Cube where all cocktails are interrelated in this really interesting historical way. And the names are prolific. There's so many different names. However, it's really, they're just twists on all of these other classics sure. that had come before it. And it's like you change out lemon for lime and you end up in a different cocktail category or a different cocktail family.
It's a sour instead of a gimlet. It's
exactly. Yeah. You know, and this happens again and again and again. And once you are kind of awakened to that, that's, I think, when cocktail making becomes really fun because you feel like you're a part of this history. And
absolutely.
This baton that's getting passed through the generations that I think maybe got dropped for a couple of decades and maybe 30 years, you know, and has been picked back up by the likes of, you know, Sasha Petrovsky and
yeah.
and all those that have followed Phil Ward, you know, and us who are students of that, you know, I'm grateful to have been in New York during the time in which that came back. That's just a fluke that I was lucky enough to find the right bar gig with the right bartenders who are willing to give me the training.
Yeah.
And now I get to kind of give my response to that, which is Donna, and for which, you know, Jeremy has, I think, achieved a really great opening
absolutely.
Cocktail list. You know?
Absolutely. Well, speaking of passing the baton and picking it back up, we're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we're going to pick up this conversation again and talk more about let's talk about some like Brooklyn.
Yeah,
totally. Let's do that. So we'll be back in just a moment, and you are listening to Leaf and Jeremy from Donna. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to This One, Life No Mind on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. No matter where it lies, but only where I am.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org today. The following message is from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Until now, if you wanted the world-class flavor of European dry cured ham, you bought prosciutto from Italy or Serrano from Spain. You also paid an ultra-premium price that goes with prestigious reputation and international shipping costs. Today, if you want one of the world's finest dry-cured hams, you have another, better option. Suriano Hams, from the Edwards Family Smokehouses in Surrey, Virginia. Their delectable Suriano Hams are all-natural, made only from purebred six-spotted Berkshire hogs. This rare breed is 100% pasture-raised to produce a perfectly marbled meat with just the right amount of internal fat to produce a rich, distinctive flavor. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
And we are back. Listening to The Speakeasy, we have Jeremy and Leaf from Donna in South Williamsburg in the studio today. We've been talking a lot about the more neighborhood approach to bartending and to the establishments that we like to hang out at. And a lot of this is born out of just Brooklyn in general. You know, yeah. It is neighborhoody, mm-hmm. You know, it's mm-hmm. not like Manhattan.
Well, and I think it's also the return of craftsmanship too.
Absolutely.
Where we have a lot of, what's been interesting about the last decade that I've spent mostly in Brooklyn, is watching college-educated, capable, intelligent people who could go out and get... They could be lawyers or doctors or whatever if they wanted to, and they haven't. They've decided to go to... They've opened farms, and they're learning how to become butchers, and they're learning how to become shoemakers, and they're learning how to do all these things. And mm-hmm. bartending is actually, I think, really it's another part of that same movement where it's another craft that was lost and is being brought back. And this is about creating a neighborhood environment.
Absolutely. I've been reading this book. Actually, my buddy Tiki Adam, he's been a repeat guest on the show.
I know Adam.
He gave me this book, which I've had for a couple of years and just now opened it, but it's called Shop Classes Soulcraft by Matthew B. Crawford. And in this book, he talks about, this guy was like a part of a Washington, D.C. think tank, and he did it for a while, and then he just like realized that he wasn't contributing to society, you know? And exactly like what you were saying, this guy is a very, very smart dude, college educated, sorry. I'm choking on this lambic that we're drinking. Awesome dude. He decided that after a while, he was like, fuck this, I'm going to open up a motorcycle shop, you know? Hands-on, like doing something that is crafty and mm-hmm. and meaningful, you know, and also like what you were just saying about becoming a bartender, like with like a college education. It's like that's something that can't be outsourced to another country.
Right.
It's something you can't do over the internet. It's something, again, like we were talking about before the show, you know, the Napoleon quote where he says, I drink champagne in victory to celebrate, and I drink champagne in defeat to console myself. So there's always going to be job security for bartenders.
Regardless of whether, when things are going tough, then people need to have a drink to forget about their sorrows and when things are going well, they have a drink to celebrate. And it's been interesting in the going through the recession and being a bartender, having that kind of perspective on it. I think, you know, the higher end stuff definitely goes down, and you know, maybe people aren't buying a fancy cocktail as much as they
yeah but we all might make a little less money right. here and there, but
it's more about
but it didn't quality. Shut down, you know. It no. doesn't bars yeah. don't ever shut down.
They're yeah. right. It's more about quality than quantity, you know. Yeah. You might be drinking less, but you're drinking better,
right?
You're partaking in something that is more meaningful. That's why, like, you know, like Stumptown Coffee and Mass Brothers Chocolates, yep. you know, like all these artisanal brands right. and like hands-on, like even like Selvedge Denim Jeans companies, yeah, yeah. you know, and like all this stuff, it's like it's higher quality. Mm-hmm. It might cost a little bit more, but you're not having to replace that pair of jeans every 6 months, right. you know.
And it's also, there's something to be said about the fact that it's being made in the community in which you're living in, you know,
yeah.
that it is a part of. It's a part of a larger vision for living. I don't know if that's conscious, but it's happened. You know, it's happening. Where,
yeah.
you know, I walk out of my apartment and I go to the local coffee store, which is roasting their beans there at the premises in which I'm buying the coffee. I go to the super, or the market, the grocery that is sourcing stuff from farms that are upstate, and you know that. I think that gets bastardized a little bit, and people, you know, kind of sneer at it as like, you know, the yuppie culture like taking over. I don't really buy into that, man, because I think that there's actually something really beautiful about it. And there is a price tag that goes along with it. Mm-hmm. But there's also, I think, there's a larger ethical, I don't know how to say it, but there's something about it that is, I think, true to how we want to live.
Well, it's more mindful and meaningful, and you know, like I've worked with people in my company who have like taken off, like you said, to like go work on farms,
yeah.
and you know, go to start a company to make like tents,
yeah.
you know, to like go camping with, and you know, I was talking with my roommate and the drummer in our band earlier today about, you know, the like motorcycle and surfing thing, how it's become more popular lately. And you know, he made a good point where it's like you have to be really mindful of what's going on when you're doing it. You can't be on your cell phone,
right?
You can't be like yeah. texting somebody.
You can't be disconnected.
Yeah, you have mm-hmm. to be extremely focused and like really in tuned with, I mean, more so with surfing than motorcycles, but in the same way, like nature and like what's around you. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I feel like a lot of people have lost focus on, you know, it's like,
but you,
and that goes back to the whole neighborhood thing.
Yeah. That's know? What I was going to say is like your bread and butter when you're running, I think when you're running a small business, when you're running a bar, when you're running a restaurant, which are the things I have more experience in doing, your bread and butter is the neighborhood. If you're trying to become like a destination spot and, you know, you're trying to run a business through the media that you gain, that's a losing battle, because the real, yeah. the people that are going to keep those doors open are the people who are coming in those doors from 2-3 blocks away. And if yeah. you can't make something that is, that fulfills their need or desire, you know, something that they can walk out the door and like, oh yeah, I'm going to walk down the street and go have a drink there, or I'm going to have a bite here, because not only do I enjoy what they serve, but I believe in it. Like it fits a part of my life, you know, that's then, you know.
Yeah. I'm still amazed by the fact that, you know, with all the social networking that's out there, you know, Facebook and, you know, things like Yelp and, you know, all these reviews you can find, how much everybody still relies on word of mouth, you know, like you
yeah,
still,
absolutely.
You know, ask your friends like for a recommendation, you know, and, you know, so that makes it very, like, it's still very important, the personal interactions you have with the customers at the bar, especially in a neighborhood spot, and especially in Brooklyn, because Brooklyn, people go out in Brooklyn because they don't want to deal with the fussiness of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. And, sure.
You know.
Sure. I mean, like, I can read, like you said, like, I can read Yelp reviews, which I don't believe in anyway, right. but, you know, yeah. like, I can read any kind of magazine review on a new place, but until you go there and experience it firsthand, or like have like someone, like a friend that you really trust, like you said, like tell you about a place, mm-hmm. then you're not necessarily going to go there, man. It's yeah. it all comes back to the whole neighborhood and like yeah. personal,
or even like getting a bar experience. Job or something. It's all still net, like yeah. we all network,
dude,
you know.
I haven't gotten,
we don't go on like Linksys or whatever
yeah.
that thing
yeah.
is.
It's, I haven't gotten a resume for a bartender that I've hired for the last 3 years.
Yeah, I don't think I've had a resume for 5 years. I really don't. I don't think I've updated, you know, because at a certain point, it's who you know in a way that sounds a lot less nepotistic than that, you know? Yeah. I mean, because it's like, you know, can you be vouched for? You know, have Absolutely. You actually worked with that person? Are they reliable? Do they show up on time?
Yeah.
Do they do a good job?
Totally. I mean, that's... Shit, man! Jeremy, I hired your wife with without a resume because I know who she is and she's awesome. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, like that. I love that we're talking about this because I don't think we've ever talked about this in depth for Brooklyn. But like, it is a network and it is community and it's in different neighborhoods, but it's all to me like one big neighborhood. And you know, even here at Roberta's, you know, it feels that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And on that point, too, it's like, in Brooklyn, you can get away with a lot more than you can
I mean, that's what makes Brooklyn so fun, because the rent isn't so high, and people experiment a little bit more than they do in the city. The risks that you take are much smaller.
Sure. Know?
And I think you can keep your price point at a place that's a little more accessible for people in Brooklyn than you can in other places, which maybe that's where that spirit of experimentation comes from.
You know? Well, also, there's... Obviously, as well, there's the audience for that.
Yeah, here. Absolutely.
Sorry, rest of the world. Brooklyn's awesome.
But it's, you know, it's funny because people, I think, I think people hate on it in a way that's insincere. I think they actually really like it, you know, like what is happening in Williamsburg and blah, blah, blah. And the minute, you know, they get pushed to the outskirts and rents start raising, they're like, oh, I can't believe this is happening. This is blah, 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 blah. It's this is what happens. This is how it goes. And there's a part of it that might be, you know, there's a part of it that might be, that might infringe upon the nostalgia of what once was and when everybody was really pioneering over here. Mm-hmm. But there's a part of it that's also about creating a community that really is self-sustaining. Like, how many times do I actually have to go into Manhattan for anything? Sure. Very few times now. I mean,
dude, I'm so neighborhoody these days. Yeah. Like, I live in Carroll Gardens. I work in Carroll Gardens.
Yeah.
And I can't.
And I'm personally, I appreciate that. I really like that. I like that I have all of this access to all these wonderful things that people really care about and put time into and put thought into.
Sure.
And I can respect. And they're within blocks of my house, you know. I don't even have a bicycle. I wish I had a bicycle, but I don't even, you know, like, I walk everywhere I go, you know.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, like, carbon footprint, man.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we're nearing the end of the show. I wanted to talk just very briefly. I mean, obviously, I want to talk more about this, but you know, and we have time constraints, but... as far as the concept with Donna, how have you seen the response? Like, and what do you basically think? What's the response been? And like, what are people drinking? And how is it going?
Tequila.
lots of tequila and tecates. Yeah? But I mean, we saw a lot of mezcal there, and you know, the mezcal tequila drink that's on the menu, the Smoky Peach, is probably the most popular drink. Right. It's like my worst enemy now because I'm so tired of making it. But,
I think we've been very lucky in the sense that I feel that we were welcomed with open arms by our community, partially because I think, you know, we again have come from that community, so we, you know, people were happy to see, you know, sons of that neighborhood come up and do something. And it's not without its challenges. I think running a new business is always challenging, and we're still, you know, we're approaching now our first half of a year of being open. And if anything, I think the most interesting thing to me is that in all of the ways I think we've faltered, the response has been to return to the original concept, which is a concept that was born out of living in that neighborhood and what I felt like didn't exist already that I wanted to create. And we've again, you know, I think been incredibly lucky, and I'm incredibly grateful to the success that we've had thus far. But we're going to keep making it better every day, you
keep
know?
Rocking.
Yeah, you got to. Like, a new business is, it's a living, breathing thing that, you know, can only be made more and more successful, and I think more enjoyable for our customers who come in there.
Well, the show has been very enjoyable for me. So anytime you guys want to come back, you should come back at Top Shop.
Awesome.
Top Shop. Yeah. You know, the door is always open, except for when Jack closes it. So thank you so much,
thank
Jeremy.
You. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Check out Donna in South Williamsburg. It's on Broadway between Wythe and Kent.
That's yep, correct,
that's
right. Yeah.
And you guys are open every day for
that's right.
business. Sorry. All right, guys. Thanks for coming on the show again, and cheers.
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 All right. We'll see you next week on Speakeasy.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.